John begins with the divinity of Jesus Christ, and he's very much stresses the divinity of Jesus Christ, his heavenly origin, celestial origin. That would be the eagle soaring overhead. And then the ox, that would be the book of Mark. There we see Jesus Christ as the servant, the greatest of servants, active, always doing something, being busy. Now, we should be active and diligent people. Nothing gets done unless, you know, there's somebody to do it. You know, if you just, there's a very silly story, but it maybe illustrates this point to an extreme. You know, we used to tell, when I was little, there were these hillbilly jokes that were very popular. And one of them was where this woman says, "Hey, Pa, your beard's on fire." And so he says, "Can't you see me praying for rain, Ma?" Well, you know, you got to do more than that. Excuse me. So the point I'm bringing out is that nothing happens if somebody doesn't do something. So you can't just, you know, lie around. We need to be active. We need to be doing things. On the other hand, we can't be workaholics. We have to have, life should be in balance. Life should be enjoyed. I understand that life is a challenge, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't enjoy life, and we shouldn't maintain our health and our well-being and emotional and physical. And so one thing that God does is he blows the whistle, he rings the bell, whatever you want to say, stop, you know, and at the end of the week, we have the Sabbath, and we stop, we pause, we rest. And so we have the Sabbath. So we work through the 6 days, you know, as it says, 6 days do your work, and the seventh day is a dramatic change. It should be a dramatic change. Our routine should really be different. It really is refreshing and helpful if your Sabbath is very different from the other 6 days. But in the book of Mark, we see both. We see the very important activities of Jesus Christ, and then we also see the importance of the Sabbath as a day of rest. I want to first go to Mark, Matthew 20. This is towards the end of the book of Matthew, and it kind of sets the basis for Mark. Mark, seeing Jesus Christ as the active one, the doer, the busy one, the servant, you know, typified by the ox there in Ezekiel. I want to go to Matthew 20, and I want to go to the 21st verse. Well, actually, I want to go farther than that. I want to go to the 25th verse. Wow, that's different. Instead of going backwards, I went forwards. Matthew 21:25. Now, I'm in the middle of a discussion here. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant." If you want to be great, then serve others. That's not easy to do. That's not, now in our society, the people who are served are the ones thought of as the VIPs. "Hey, you, get up, you know, do this, do that. I need this, I need that," right? You've seen it. The VIPs are the ones who order other people around and who are served. But not in on God's scale. He looks at the one who's serving as the great one. "And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave." Verse 28. "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served." That's not why Jesus Christ came, obviously. What more can a person do for others than what he did? Wow. "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." So this is, in a way, at the end of Matthew, preparing us for Mark, where Jesus Christ is so active, so busy. And one of the expressions you're going to see in Mark over and over again is the word "immediately." Evidently, in the Greek, we have the word ephthios or ephthys. There are two forms that I think we find, ephthios and ephthys. I hope I'm doing justice to the Greek. Mark, let's go to the book of Mark. And first of all, what's Mark about? Well, it's, of course, the good news of the kingdom of God. Let me summarize that. the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So now we're in Mark. So right away he identifies, you know, what he's talking about, who he's talking about. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And now let's go to verse 14. Now after John was put in prison, Jesus came to Galilee preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God and saying, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. So believe that there is going to be a solution to the world's problems. We're just not going to go on and on and on, cycling back up and down. There's coming a, you know, actually there is going to be progress. The history is heading in a direction, and it's going to work out, not because of us, but in spite of us, but, you know, because of God's intervention, it is going to work out. But it not entirely in spite of us, because we can be praying on a daily basis, your kingdom come. And those prayers eventually do have the impact. So if you look at the book of Mark, you'll find the Greek word, as I said, that is translated often immediately. It may be translated in various ways in your Bibles. Maybe straight away, or maybe, you know, just as he did this, you know, he did the other. Let's go to verse 10. Well, let's go to verse 9. This time I am backing up. And it came to pass in those days, Mark 1:9, that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. By the way, there's some symbolism there that I'll comment on in a moment. Well, I think I'll do it right now. God works in the Bible through teams, through two witnesses, an older man and a younger man, and an austere priestly figure and a very affable kingly figure. And we have these teams through the Bible. We have Enoch and Noah. We have Aaron and Moses. We have Caleb and Joshua. We have Zerubbabel and Joshua, and so on. We have these teams, these two witnesses. We'll have two witnesses in the end time. And we have Elijah and Elisha. Elijah, the austere, sort of scary personality. And then Elisha, who evidently was more the kind of person you'd want to have at a party. You'd want to have Elijah at the party maybe to consult him and get advice from him. But he wouldn't necessarily be the one who'd be the life of the party. Probably possibly Elisha would be the life of the party. And the same thing with John the Baptist and Jesus Christ. John the Baptist would be there to probably keep things under control. But Jesus would be there really having a good time with everybody. Even now, he is God in the flesh, so keep that in mind. It's very fascinating. When Jesus came to earth, when God came to earth, the Word of God in the form of Jesus Christ, he was not religious enough for some people. How could God not be religious enough for some people? But that's the way it was. Some of the Pharisees were saying, you know, tisk, tisk, you know, what are you doing? And this is to the being who created all human beings and gave the law and so forth. But, you know, that's for another, you know, there's a lot in that. But anyway, so we have Jesus, John the Baptist and Jesus Christ, and they are typified by Elisha and Elijah. Elijah and Elisha. So remember that Elisha asked for a light from Elijah. I want a double portion of your spirit. And he got it, evidently, because Elijah told him how he, you know, what would happen, and to indicate to him that that was going to happen, and it did. So now Elisha goes out and he performs all kinds of miracles. Elijah did miracles, but Elisha does so many more. And that's the concept in Mark. You have John the Baptist, and then you have Jesus Christ going out and doing all these miracles, very much like what Elisha did. And so you could do a personal study. I was going to do that today, but I decided to go in another direction. But you could do an interesting study about how Mark shows Jesus Christ as an antitype of Elisha and the various parallels there between Elisha, Hanavi, Elisha the prophet, and Jesus Christ. So here you have Jesus being very, very active and doing a lot of miracles, whereas John the Baptist didn't do any miracles. I want to go to John 10 and verse 41 for just a moment. John 10 and verse 41. Then many came to him and said, John performed no sign, but all the things that John spoke about this man were true. And many believed in him there. So John, with all his greatness, was not a miracle worker, but Jesus was. So let's, with that background, now go to the book of Mark. As it shows Jesus being very active, but also showing him talking about the Sabbath. Let's go to Mark 1:9. And it came to pass in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And immediately, coming up from the water, he saw the heavens parting and the Spirit descending upon him like a dove. Then a voice came from heaven, "You are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." Immediately the Spirit drove him into the wilderness. And he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted by Satan, and was with the wild beasts, and the angels ministered to him. And I already read verse 14 and 15, so let's go to verse 16. And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then Jesus said to them, verse 17, "Follow me, and I will make you, and I will make you become fishers of men." They immediately left their nets and followed him. You get the idea? A lot of action going on. Boom, boom, boom. When he had gone a little farther from there, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who also were in the boat immediately. mending their nets. And immediately, all right, we got there. This is verse 20. He called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him. So you get the idea. The concept is, I guess, fast-moving action, fast pace. If this were a movie, it would be the kind of movie that kind of jars me. Some of these modern movies, everybody's talking so fast and it's clipped and boom, 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 and all these scenes are coming at me, and you know, it's for me, it's a bit too much.
That word appears 41 times.
Okay, so we have a contribution now from Daniel. He says that that word appears 41 times. There's only 16 chapters. All right. So you get the idea that there's a lot happening very fast. Well, his whole ministry was only 3.5 years. And you remember what John said. John said, if I had to write everything he did, there wouldn't be enough paper and pen and ink, you know. So he's very active. He's doing a lot. But yet he takes the time to talk about the Sabbath. And I want to contend today that the Sabbath is intended to be the universal day of rest. It was given to Israel. And it's been very important, critically important, in preserving the identity of Israel. But that's because Israel was intended to be a model, an example. They were not chosen because, you know, they were better than other people. God decided to work with human beings by taking a nation, training that nation, and then that nation be the example for the other nations. So everybody has to wind up, ultimately, eating crow, even though it's an unclean bird. You have to eat crow. What does that mean? The Jewish people, who are part of Israel, and the only part that anybody knows about now, pretty much, the only Israelites people know about now are the Jews, because they kept the Sabbath all these centuries. So the Jews who are part of Israel, what do they have to do? They're going to have to accept Jesus Christ. Wow. You know, there's the one thing that Jews in America have in common, probably the only thing, is they reject Christianity. That's about the main thing that they have in common. Now, there are some Messianics. But, you know, if you go to a Messianic congregation, and I have, if you go to a Messianic congregation, you'll probably find 5% of the people there are Jewish, about 95% are not. They're what you might call wannabes. And I'm grateful that people want to be Jewish, because in the old days, when we were Jewish, we had to keep a low profile. We didn't want anybody necessarily to know we were Jewish. But the fact that you've got all these people who want to be Jewish, wow, that's exciting. But if you go to a Messianic congregation, as I said, only about 5% of the people there will be Jewish. Because what really unites at least the American Jewish community is basically the fact that they're not Christian. But the time is coming when the Jewish people are going to be reconciled to Jesus Christ. You know, you could call them super Jew. They're going to be reconciled to Jesus Christ. What about the rest of the world? Well, the rest of the world has basically been anti-Semitic, let's face it. They're going to have to understand that they're going to have to look to Israel as the example. And they're going to have to be humbled to the extent to realize that, you know, whatever their nationality, they've got to celebrate holidays now that they used to think of as Jewish holidays. You know, now they're going to be, and the Jewish Sabbath will become, as I said, the universal day of rest for everybody. The seventh day of the week, which in many languages that, you know, you find that already, even in Arabic. And in Spanish and in Portuguese, and you know, the seventh day is called Sabato or some version of that. I think even in Greek. Now, it's true that in some languages, Sunday is called the Lord's Day because they believe that somehow that becomes now the day that Christians should observe. But even so, they do preserve in their language the concept of Sabbath, Saturday being Sabbath. By the way, in the Portuguese language, many of you perhaps have some awareness of Brazil. I want to tell you, living in Orlando, Brazil is big here. We have a lot of tourists who come here from Brazil, and we have a lot of Brazilians who live here in Orlando. Believe it or not, you can drive through Orlando and you can see billboards in Portuguese. Can you? How many places do you have that? We actually have ads, billboards, that you, as you're driving down the street here in Orlando, and you can see billboards in Portuguese. That's the Brazilian influence here. Well, look up in Portuguese. What is Monday? You know what Monday is in Portuguese? The second day, just like in Hebrew. And Tuesday is the third day, and Wednesday is the fourth day, and Thursday is the fifth day, and Friday is the sixth day, and then Saturday is Sabato, or Sabado, however they pronounce it in Portuguese. You know, so there's that memory that's there. But someday people are going to, around the world, keep the seventh day, keep the Sabbath as the universal day of rest. I want to go to Genesis 2. And in Genesis 2, we find at the creation of human beings, the Sabbath is discussed. It goes all the way back to there, to the creation of human beings. Genesis 2. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done. And he rested on the seventh day and from all his work which he had done. You find the Hebrew word is the same word for Sabbath, that he rested. You know, he ceased from work. It is the Hebrew word is the same word for Sabbath. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created it should be to make. What does it mean that God had created to make? Well, think about it. When we create something now, we're not really creating it in the true sense, because we're using material that exists, and we're doing something with it to create something else. You know, so we're really making something. You see what I'm saying? We don't create anything, you know, ex nihilo in Latin or Hebrew, yesh me'ayin. We don't create something from nothing. We don't have that power. We can do a lot, but we have to start with something. Well, God starts just with himself, and he creates a spirit realm, and then he creates a material realm. So he created in order to make things, you know. So that's why I believe it says he created to make, because you have to have something before you have anything else. And so he created the tools, you know, the substance from which he could then make whatever he wanted to make. So that makes sense? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so here you have the word Sabbath in two different forms, twice in this passage, as I recall. Vayishpot b'yom ha'shivi mikol melachto asher asah, vayivarech Elohim et yom ha'shivi vayikadesh oto kivo shavat mikol melachto. Yeah, so going it over in my mind in Hebrew, the Sabbath is there twice, the word Sabbath. So God rested on the seventh day. And so here we have Adam and Eve created on the sixth day, and then we have God resting on the seventh day. Now let's go to Genesis 8. And here at the time of Noah, we find a week. We find a seven-day period discussed. So it seems that from the earliest times, the concept of a seven-day period. Noah, let's go to Genesis 7, verse 4. And after 7 more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. So here we go, 7 days, Genesis 7:4. Now let's go to Genesis 8, and let's go to Genesis 8. How about verse 10? He sends out a dove in verse 10, and he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent a dove out from the ark. Let's go to verse 12. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him anymore. Oh, so we have two other periods of 7 days here. So three different times in Genesis 7 and 8, we have periods of 7 days. So you see that concept of 7 day periods, it goes back to the most ancient times, most ancient records that we have. But as you know, God gave that day specifically to the Israelites. He taught them when it was miraculously in Exodus 16. And then in Exodus 20, commanded them to keep the Sabbath. And in Deuteronomy, it's repeated. And in Exodus 20, it's talked about as a memorial of creation. In Deuteronomy 5, it's talked about as a memorial of the Exodus, as God freed Israel from slavery. So both of those aspects are there, God as creator and God as redeemer. And certainly we Christians can appreciate that very deeply. We have a certain rest in Jesus Christ. You go to Matthew 11. And you go to Hebrews 4. You know, we have a rest now, and we're looking forward to even a greater rest later that the Sabbath reminds us of from week to week. Reminds us of our present rest and reminds us of our future rest. But he first gave it to Israel as an example to other nations. Exodus 31 and verse 16. And it's a covenant, a separate covenant. I have found 12 covenants in the Bible, and one of them is the Sabbath. It's a distinct covenant. God, I don't mean everybody making covenants. I mean divine covenants. I have found 12 divine covenants, and this is one of them, the Sabbath. It's a divine covenant. Exodus 31 and verse 16. I know I'm in them breaking into a thought. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. Brit Olam. Brit Olam, a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Eternal made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. Shavat Vayinafash. He rested and was refreshed. So it's a covenant. Now I want to talk about another covenant, because it comes up in the book of Mark. Another covenant that's less known. And I'm going to make a confession to you. I gave a sermon that I think had a very profound impact on the church that I served back then. A greater impact than I could ever have known at the time. I gave it, I think, back in 1988. And I called it the Ten Covenants. And I should have called it the 12 Covenants. But it took me time to realize that there are 12. And this is one that I didn't talk about that day. But I'm talking about it now. Wikipedia has 9? Okay, well, I'll have to see where I disagree with the Wikipedia. I'm not going to back down, but I'll see where I disagree with them. Okay, Leviticus 24. I can understand maybe where, but let's take a look at Leviticus 24. 9? They only have 9? Mm-hmm. All right. That's going to be fun. All right. Leviticus 24 and verse 5. And you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. As I recall, each of these would be like 3 or 4 loaves of bread. And since there are 12 of them, that's what, about 48, what is it, 36, 48 loaves of bread. So, you know, a lot of people could be fed. That's a possibility. And you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be for each cake, shall be in each cake. And you shall set them in 2 rows, 6 in a row. You see, as you know from 1 Corinthians 14, God likes to do everything decently and in order. You shall set them in 2 rows, 6 in a row, on the pure gold table before the Eternal. Now, by the way, a lot of instructions were given about that table, and I want to go back to Exodus 25. I'm not going to read all the instructions, but I want to just tell you, you can look at it in Exodus 25. Now, I've been going through the Pentateuch, and I'm in Deuteronomy now, because this year is a year to read the Pentateuch through. It's a sabbatical year, and I've been reading through the Pentateuch, and now I'm in Deuteronomy. So you can keep up with me and on Twitter and see where I am. No, I'm kidding. But Exodus 25 and verse 30. And you shall set the showbread on the table before me always. So as long as there was a tabernacle in the wilderness or a temple later on, the beautiful implements you read about here were used for the showbread. You can read about them there in Deuteronomy, and in Exodus 25 and verse 30 talks about the showbread. And now I want to go to 24 in Leviticus. 24 in Leviticus now. Verse 6, and you shall set them in 2 rows, 6 in a row, on the pure gold table before the Eternal, and you shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be on the bread for memorial, an offering made by fire to the Eternal. I know you're going to get angry with me, some of you, for talking about this, but there was a movie called 7 Brides for 7 Brothers, and these 7 brothers were named in alphabetical order. I think one was Adam, one was Benjamin, I think maybe Caleb. Well, anyway, Daniel. Well, anyway, when you got to the letter F, the guy's name was Frank, and his full name was Frankincense, which I guess kind of embarrassed him, you know. But anyway, he was called Frankincense, but they called him Frank, as I recall. All right. Anyway, sorry about that. All right. Anyway, Leviticus 24:7, and you shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be on the bread for a memorial, an offering made by fire to the Eternal. You're baking this bread, so it becomes a like a burnt offering. Hopefully. Not to the extent that you can't eat it, you know. Every Sabbath, so it is connected to the Sabbath. It's interesting. They are interrelated, because each Sabbath is when you put this bread out. Every Sabbath you shall set it in order before the Eternal continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. And who eats it? So each Sabbath, who eats the old bread, you know, before it gets stale and puts the new bread out? Aaron and his sons, the priests. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons, this is verse 9, and they shall eat it in a holy place. So they can't just go wherever they want to go. It has to be eaten there. It's really special. So probably as they're eating it, they're going to be having very serious discussions about very important matters. Not just who might win the Super Bowl or something like that, but, you know, other things. Because you're in a holy place, so you're going to be in the mood, right? And it shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him, from the offerings of the eternal made by fire, by a perpetual covenant. I'm sorry, a perpetual statute. But earlier it is called a covenant in verse 8, so let me focus on that. It's a perpetual statute, but let me go back to verse 8. Every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the eternal, continually being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. So here's another covenant. I didn't mention it in 1988, but I am now. I have since, don't get me wrong. This is not the first time I'm talking about it. Okay, so, and it's reconnected to the Sabbath. Now, why would God make this an everlasting covenant? Why is this so important? I think it's the symbolism here. There were 12 loaves of bread for the 12 tribes of Israel. Because, as I said, God works through people. He worked through certain families. He worked through the family of David. You know, sorry, if you're not a descendant of David, you can't be the Messiah. You know, sorry, bzz, you know, you lose. You have to be Davidic. And also there was the priesthood, the Levites and the Aaronites. And later on, it'll only be the Zadokites that are the priests, and the other Aaronites will be Levites with the rest. They will assist, but the descendants of Zadok will be the priests in the millennium. And so on, you know. So God works through people, and he worked through a nation of Israel. And so to remember that Israel is to be the model nation. So in a sense, the culture of the world emanates from Israel. The theology emanates from the Greek-speaking world because they have the New Testament. But the culture of the world, the holy days, the dietary laws, the cultural activities, they emanate from Israel. Is everybody okay? So, you know, you could have your own spin on it, but that's my spin on it. Now let's go to 1 Samuel 21. And here we find that under an extreme situation, exceptions were made. God is a God of mercy. A very wonderful historian named Paul Johnson. I love him dearly. I've never met him. He's still alive. He's a very old man. As far as I know, he's still alive. Very lovable. Paul Johnson says that people who are ideologues, intellectuals, what differs them from other types of people is that they put ideas above people. You know, think of what happened in Cambodia. Last week, there was the anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp. Now it's a Holocaust Memorial Day for the United Nations. But, you know, since Auschwitz was liberated in 1945, we've had Cambodia, we've had Rwanda, we've had, you know, it's just horrible. We've had genocides continuing on. But many times when you have these mass slaughters of people, it's because people decide on a certain principle, a certain idea, and that becomes more important than people. So anyway, we go to 1 Samuel 21. Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" Well, David was already, you know, a persona non grata. This Saul was after him. And David, in this case, lied to Ahimelech. And I think that partly it was done to protect him. Because now Ahimelech could say, "He told me he was sent by the king. You know, I wasn't harboring him. I wasn't rescuing him. He came here and told me he was sent by the king." So this, it was in a way of trying to spare Ahimelech, which unfortunately it didn't work. But at least he tried. At least David tried to spare his life. So he wasn't bearing false witness against his neighbor. In effect, he was bearing false witness to protect his neighbor. And remember, David was a warrior. He took people's lives. If you're going to be a warrior and take people's lives, then being dishonest is, you know, is a part of being a warrior. When countries go to war, they not only take lives, but they also, if they can, deceive the other country. So the other country doesn't know what they're up to. That's all part of it. In fact, there's a movie out now. I haven't seen it. But it's called, what is it, The Enigma or something? No, something about the code. The Imitation Code.
Imitation Game.
I'm sorry, The Imitation. All right, there's a movie called The Imitation Game. And it had to do with World War II. And it had to do with the fact that the British had broken the code of the Germans, but at the same time, they didn't want the Germans to know that they had broken the code. So there were times when they took some hits so the Germans would know that they really knew what the Germans were up to. So they were, in effect, deceiving the Germans. Well, if you're going to be killing Germans in a war, then deceiving them, you know, it goes right along with it, you know. Now, Washington, I know they say that Washington never told a lie, but I think if you study Washington's strategy with the British, he tried to trick them as much as he could, you know. All right, anyway, verse 2. So David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you. And I have directed my young men to such and such a place.'" But they're starving, you know. So now, therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, now it's interesting, he didn't take his men and try to pillage the place. He's David. He's a man after God's own heart. So he respectfully asked the priest for help, just as he did with Nabal at first. Remember that story? That's one of my stories that I often read. He asked him respectfully at first, right? All right. And the priest answered David and said, "There is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread." If the okay, so he was willing to give him the show bread. It's not for him. It's only for the priests. But these guys are starving. So he let him have the holy bread. However, he still said, since it's holy bread, we want to keep the standards up. So hopefully you haven't had any sexual relations recently. See, what God did was he wanted the sacrifices to not be connected with sexual activity because, you know, in the pagan religions, there was fornication in connection with the sacrificial system, as well as murder for that matter. Children were being killed, offered up as sacrifices. And then, you know, there was sexual activity connected with the pagan rituals. And so God wanted to clear the deck on that. So you weren't, if you had sex, you wouldn't immediately then go off for sacrifice. You couldn't do it. And this reminds me of another story. Do I have time to tell it? Well, I guess I'll go ahead. There was this cartoon I saw many years ago. And there's these Mayans or Aztecs. And they're at the base of a pyramid, and they've taken this teenage girl to sacrifice her, and they're taking her up the steps to the altar to sacrifice her, and she's resisting and battling and everything. So these two older people are standing back, and they're talking. These young people, they don't believe in anything anymore. Sorry about that. All right. Anyway, now therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, "There is no common bread on hand. But there is holy bread. If the young men have at least kept themselves from women," and in fact they have, the poor fellows, look what it says. "Then David answered the priest and said to him, 'Truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out.'" So we haven't had sex for 3 days. So they haven't had food or sex for quite a while. At least they're going to have food now. Excuse me. "And the vessels of the young men are holy." In other words, these people are—they're ready. They're ready for the holy bread. They're untouched there. "And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day." So he's saying there's such a severe need that this bread has now become available because there's such a severe need. So the priest gave him a holy bread, for there was no bread there but the show bread, which had been taken from before the Eternal, in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. So evidently, you know, the fires were prepared before Sabbath, the bread was kept warm, and then, it was taken away, and new bread was put there for the Sabbath. So now they had the old bread that they were supposed to eat, but they gave it to David's people, at least 5 loaves they gave to David's people. So the covenant was broken, but under extreme circumstances. Now the same thing is true of the Sabbath. You know, the ox in the ditch principle. In an emergency situation, the Sabbath can be violated because it's a serious emergency, right? Ox in the ditch. Let's go now to Mark 2. Now, the Jews had been told, Israel had been told in Matthew 26, that one reason that they were being punished was for lack of Sabbath observance. And if you read in the book of Nehemiah, that was a critical problem in his day. He was really concerned about it. Well, the Pharisees got very extreme about the Sabbath, and they had made it a burden, a very complex matter. The Sabbath in Pharisaic tradition is an extremely complex matter. All kinds of do's and don'ts. And so when Jesus came, he came to some degree to reform the keeping of the Sabbath, to get back to the original intent of the Sabbath. So let's go to Mark 2, and I'll pick up the account in verse 23, Mark 2, 23. Now it happened that he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and he's teaching them. They're having a stroll, and he's teaching them. Now there's a parallel account in Matthew 12 and a parallel account in Luke 6, but I'm focusing today on the account in Mark, and that's why I'm saying, call this talk Remarks on the Universal Day of Rest. By the way, it is going to become a universal day of rest. I want to go to, before I continue in this passage in Mark, I want to go to a prophecy in Isaiah. Isaiah 66. Let's go to the end of the book of Isaiah, or Isaiah, some of you would say. Yeshayahu. Sefer Yeshayahu. Isaiah, or Isaiah. I want to go to the 23rd verse, almost the end of the book. And talking about the future, talking about the distant future, and I hope it's not so distant now. And it shall come to pass, Isaiah 66:23, that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come to worship before me, says the Eternal. So how will people keep time around the world? From new moon to new moon, from Sabbath to Sabbath, they're going to keep time. And when they come to worship God, they're going to come to worship him from new moon to new moon, from Sabbath to Sabbath. You know that when the temple is standing, there'll be sacrifices specifically for the Sabbath, sacrifices specifically for the new moon. I was thinking about that just the other day, not necessarily that verse, but the concept of God's calendar, the sacred calendar. You know, if you look up in the evening at the moon, you generally know what day of the month it is. So it makes sense for the day to begin at dark, because you can look up and see, oh, okay, there's the moon, and we're now about the ninth day of the month, tenth day of the month. You can still tell by how full the moon is. So it makes sense for the day to begin then, because you can look up and say, okay, it's day number 10, because you see how, if you know the phases of the moon well, you can pretty much nail it. Is everybody all right? Mm-hmm. All right, let's go back to Mark 2. So the Sabbath is going to be the universal day of rest, not just for Israel, but for the whole world. It starts with Israel. It started originally with the first human beings, I would suppose, you know, with Adam and Eve and so on. But eventually it was lost, although it was kept in a distorted form in Babylon. The ancient Babylonians had a distorted form. They had a Sabbath, and it was not exactly the Sabbath of the seventh day. It was like every 2 weeks or so they had some kind of a rest day or something. Maybe in the middle of the new moon, in the middle of each month on a lunar cycle, I think they had a special day of rest. You could study into that. So they had some form of a Sabbath in ancient Iraq. But in the future, from Israel, it will spread, and the Sabbath will be kept around the world. I want to go now to Mark 2. Now, it happened that he went through the excuse me, that he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. And as they went, his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. They're hungry. They're walking along. So they take a little handful of grain. There's nothing violated here. It is violating the Pharisaic law. Rabbinic law? Definitely a violation of rabbinic law. But since Christ was sinless, they weren't violating God's law. To just walk along the road, and when you're hungry, to take something edible that's there, you know, that could happen nowadays too. Maybe you're walking where there's blueberries. So you take some blueberries and eat them. Anyway, and the Pharisees said to him, look, why do you do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? So he could have said a lot of things to them, but what he did was he took the most extreme case. He went all the way back to what David did. He said, you know, David's people were really hungry, and they even took the holy bread. They went to a much greater extreme than what we're going to. All we're doing is really violating one of your traditions. David even went beyond that. He literally violated a divine law, but it was considered okay because of the circumstances. In other words, people are, you know, people matter. But he said to them, have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry and those with him? Why did he choose that example? As I said, that was a covenant. The Sabbath is a covenant. I read it to you. Exodus 31, it's a distinct covenant. Well, so is the showbread covenant. I read it to you. Leviticus 24:8, I read it to you. And they're also interconnected because the showbread was put out every Sabbath. So there are covenants that are even interconnected. So it was a beautiful example to bring, and it was a very extreme case that he brought. Much more extreme than what his people were doing, but he wanted to make a point that even sometimes with a divine law, it can be superseded in an extreme situation. On the other hand, what he was also doing was telling them, you have made the Sabbath much too burdensome for people with your traditions. You need to, you know, make some reforms here. It's very important to respect the Sabbath, very important, but you don't want to make it a burden. Anyway, verse 26. How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priests, and also gave some to those who were with him. So he not only did he have some, David, the future king, but even those who were with him. They were not all of them necessarily even saintly people either. He had a ragtag group of people. But he fed them because they were starving. And so here's what he says. He said to them, the Sabbath was made for the Jews. No! It's not what he says. He doesn't say the Sabbath was made for Israel. It's not what he says. The Sabbath was made for human beings. Ah. And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. It's a gift. It's a gift. 6 days a week we work, and then the Sabbath comes and we stop, and it's a gift. I think that, isn't that what maybe Senator Lieberman called his book? Recently, a United States senator who was a Sabbath keeper wrote a book about it. I think he called it The Gift of Rest. The Gift of Rest. Well, verse 28. And because the Sabbath was made for man, therefore Jesus Christ, who represents the human race, who actually created the human race, is therefore Lord of the Sabbaths. So he can tell us how to keep the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. So because the Sabbath was made for human beings, Jesus Christ could come and illustrate as the human being par excellence, the representative of humankind, the second Adam. He could illustrate how to keep the Sabbath, and he did keep the Sabbath. He was sinless. He kept the Sabbath, but at the same time, he showed that the Sabbath ought to be kept in a way that it does not become an extreme burdensome matter. And because you know what has happened with many Jews, they have thrown out the baby with the bathwater. It became so complicated to keep the Sabbath that they tended to scrap it. Now, I'll have to give them credit. Many of them have not. Many of them keep the Sabbath now in a more balanced fashion, and some have gone overboard and I think are too secular the way to keep it. They still keep it, but in a more secular way, I think they've gone to the other extreme. So it becomes a kind of a secular day of rest, so you don't have to focus on the spiritual as you should. But we, as God's people, as Christians, can keep the Sabbath in a Christian fashion, a New Testament a Sabbath. That is to say, you know, we can look in the Bible and we can look at the examples in the New Testament and we can put together the data and we can come up with what would be appropriate, you know, our conscience guided by God's Spirit. Now, there are going to be some gray areas and some people may, you know, have certain approaches that others don't have. And there may be times when the community has to come together and maybe administrative decisions need to be made for the sake of peace in the community, or at least recommendations made. But generally speaking, I think most people who are part of the Church of God and are Sabbath keepers generally would have a consensus about what should or shouldn't be done. Mark 2 and verse 27. And he said, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath. So in this book of Mark, which is a really fascinating book to study, where Jesus is shown as very, very active, we also have this very important passage on the Sabbath, on the covenant of the Sabbath. And we see that indeed, these are remarks about the universal day of rest. I'd like to now go to Q&A. Q&A. for our Q&A, I'm still talking about the daughters of Zelophehad because there's one last point I wanted to make about those daughters. Remember, there were five daughters of Zelophehad. He didn't have any son. So they said, why can't we inherit? So God said, yes, you can inherit. And then people said, yes, but if they inherit, they'll marry people outside the tribe, and then the inheritance will be lost. So then God said, okay, yes, they can inherit the land, but now they need to marry within their tribe. I want to go now to Numbers 26. Numbers 26. Why do they call it the Book of Numbers? Well, because there's a census in the beginning and a census at the end. Let's go to the second census at the end of the Book of Numbers. Numbers 26. I'm going to go to the second verse. Take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and above by their fathers' houses, all who are able to go to war in Israel. So this is the eligible males, you might say, the ones who could theoretically go to war, 20 and above. So these would also be the men available to marry. These would be the men available to marry. If they aren't already married, these would be the ones available to marry. And of course, in that society, for that matter, polygamy was also practiced. But I want to go to verse 34. And here we come to Manasseh. Okay, because the daughters of Zelophehad were Manassites, so they had to marry within the tribe of Manasseh. So look at verse 34. These are the families of Manasseh, and those who were numbered of them were 52,700. So I would say there were enough eligible men for these five women. There were 52,700 men. Now, I realize some of them were already married, but I think they could come up with five eligible men. So that they should have been taken care of. I would like to thank you. I have a neighbor named Gary who had very severe health problems, and I asked you to pray for him. And it has been improving to some extent. Now, as far as I know, it's not major, but there have been improvements. So they had a tube that they had put inside of him, I guess, to feed him or whatever, so they could breathe. But anyway, that's been removed. So I would think that's a step forward. If he doesn't need to have that tube stuck in him, if he can now, that means now he can talk to people. If he wakes up if he gets conscious, he can actually interact with people and talk and so on. So that, I would say, is progress. So thanks very much for your prayers. Please continue to pray for my neighbor, Gary. I also want to ask prayers for the family of the Bohannans who are out there in the attend over there in the West Valley area in Chatsworth at least at times, and they have come to my Bible studies when I've had them out there. So this is Pat Bohannan. This is Mrs. Bohannan. She has some health issues, and she does need our prayers to get back into full health. So please pray for the health, complete healing and health of Pat Buchanan. I'm sorry, Bohannan. Buchanan is a similar name. This is Bohannan. Pat Bohannan. I believe her husband is Jim, right? Jim Bohannan. So anyway, please pray for that family and pray for Pat Bohannan and her complete recovery. And I'm sure that they would appreciate it. And I want to thank the family that sent us the information about the Bohannans. And I do appreciate these emails we get, not only when there's a crisis, but also updates. You know, I'm trying to update you when you pray for somebody, you'd like to know, well, you know, what's the status. So that's why I'm trying to update you on Gary. And as I hear more about the Bohannans, I'll update you on Pat Bohannan as well and how she's doing it. And I certainly hope and pray that she'll be completely well, and I hope I can report that to you next Sabbath. We are, I believe, today in the 11th day of the 11th month. So that means, I think, on Wednesday, right, is the 15th. Sunday would be the 12th. Monday's the 13th. Tuesday the 14th. So Wednesday would be the 15th. The 15th day of the 11th month, which is an Arbor Day on the calendar. In ancient times, people figured their tithes of their fruit trees from the 15th of Shavuot. That was the new year for the trees. That's when the seasons somewhat shift in Israel. The heavy rains go to the light rains, and the almond trees begin to bud. My apologies to Joe Bohannan. I called him Jim. My apologies. He's Joe Bohannan. And his wife is Pat. And I know Joe, a while back, was having a problem with one of his knees, and I believe that he's doing well on that. And so, I'm glad I believe that problem is behind him. He at one time was having a problem with a knee, and I believe that he's able now to get around, and that problem has been resolved. So, Joe, my apologies for calling you Jim. Joe Bohannon and Pat Bohannon. And as I said, Joe hopefully is over that knee issue, and hopefully Pat will be over her health issues. So as I said, on the 15th day of the 11th month, traditionally was a time to take note of trees. And so in the land of Israel, people will be out planting trees. And then a month later will be the festival of Purim, which means that if you think about this Wednesday, it's only 2 months away from the days of unleavened bread. So we are getting closer to the spring and closer to the days of unleavened bread. As we get to Wednesday, we'll be about 2 months prior to the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread. So the year is moving right along. So thanks again to you for your interest in our educational activities here. We hope that, as I talked about the Sabbath, that indeed we will continue to honor the Sabbath and enjoy the Sabbath rest. For those of you who are hearing this at other times, we hope and pray that life is going well for you. All the best to you and yours.